Coming to you from across the planet via Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, and all other listening platforms where podcasts can be heard, we are also syndicated courtesy of WNJHradio.com. Welcome, everyone, to the Dan Morrow Show. I am Dan Morrow, and with me is a good friend I've known for almost 25 years. He is a legendary singer-performer, Gary Puckett. You know him from the band Gary Puckett and Union Gap. You know his songs, such hits as Young Girl, Lady Willpower, Woman, Woman, and This Girl's a Woman Now. At the time of this recording, the nation and the planet, for the most part, is under quarantine during the COVID-19 pandemic. We're all wishing you well, and I'm wishing well my next guest. Gary, welcome to the show. How have you been?
Well, thank you, Dan. I'm glad to be here, and we have been well, and we're staying staying our distance and doing what we're supposed to do in order that we hopefully do not get the COVID-19.
Now, are you still in Florida?
We are. We're in Clearwater, Florida, and
okay.
It's a wonderful place to be. We got beautiful weather right now, so that's where we are.
Now, is your beach closed? Your beaches are closed? I know. I heard some were still open in Florida.
I don't know about some. I know that ours has been closed. The police department showed up at our building, basically, and spoke to the building manager and said, you know, beaches are closed, but if you live here, it's okay to go out and walk. We just don't want you to congregate. So we're fairly free to go out and put our feet in the sand and look up at the sunshine. So it's a wonderful thing.
Now, I have to ask, before all this madness happened, what was your calendar looking like? Did you have a pretty good schedule coming up?
Yeah, it wasn't too bad, and the year was, just getting started, really.
Mm-hmm.
So we had about 10 things canceled, which is, that's a lot for us.
And, it is.
Now, some of them have been moved to later in the year, so we're grateful for that part, but some simply went away, but I guess that's just what's going to happen.
Now, what do you do in the meantime? Do you just chill and relax, or do you still try to stay in shape? Do you still practice? Do you have the other? I know most of the guys you play with are from different parts of the country. I guess they just keep focusing on their part. They know their job.
Well, we've all got our issues. States, I guess, but Woody's in South Carolina, Jamie is in Austin, Texas, and Mike is in Las Vegas. So yeah, they're all pretty much locked down like we are. We've had an order to stay home unless you need to go to medical services or you need to go to the grocery or something else that's vital, like work. What we're all doing, I'm not really sure. I know Jamie sent me a video the other day. He was sitting in his little studio and was creating music and kind of, what is it I want to say here, creating sounds that will be applied to our show as well, because he's quite, what's the word I want? He's attentive to detail in a lot of things. So even though we're only a three-piece band plus one, and I say that because I'm good enough to be the guitar player, but I don't play a lot of guitar in the show. The three guys behind me are tasked with doing a 30-piece orchestra oftentimes, and Jamie is pretty amazing that way. So
Jamie,
that's what he's doing. I know
he's your keyboard player, right? He's your keyboard player, right?
Jamie Hillbolt, that's correct. He also does our fan page and things like that. He's really tech savvy, where I'm just an old dinosaur in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
I never kept up with it, but at any rate, Mike, I think, is dealing with it day by day. So is Woody. Woody directs his church, the choir, and other aspects of what they do, their technical aspects and things like that. So they've gone to online, like so many have, and did you, by the way, hear about the pastor in Florida that was packing his church 500 people a day until Chad Cronister, who is, the sheriff, said, you do that again, you're going to jail. And he did it again, and he went to jail. So people are a little surprised by that. But, Mr. Chronister, Sheriff Chronister, said it's not about, you know, the First Amendment or any other. It's all about the COVID-19, so we got to keep everybody safe. So I know I got off track, but
that's
yeah, everybody's
all right.
Kind of doing their thing and doing what they have to do. We have our daughter with us. She's a doctor, and she is just finishing up her residency. So she is an MD. She is a hospitalist and a pediatrician and has been working 15-hour days, partly because of the situation we're in with the pandemic and partly because she was finishing her residency. But being the brilliant doctor that she is, they were keeping her at the hospital 15 hours every day. So we've had her and the three children living with us. Our grandkids are 6, 3, and 8 months. So it's wonderful, and it's trying all at the same time because
I'm sure.
Dealing with a 3-year-old mental child that uses something else.
Yeah, I'm sure of it. I'm sure. Now, I've known you for quite some time, but we rarely have time to talk with each other and really get to know each other. And so I do want to ask you, what turned you on to music? How did this all this start for you, especially with
your... Yeah. Well, the way that it started and the reason that it started was my parents. They were extremely musical, both of them. She was a fabulous pianist through her life, taught, played for, you know, functions and for church and things like that. And she had a some sort of a, you know, one of those cymbals or something that was the kind of organ that has the pedals and all the stops and things that, you know, so she had the organ, she had an acoustic piano in the house. And since I was a kid, there was always music in the house. She was a wonderful singer. My dad was a great singer and a sax player, and that's how they met. They were both in a big band right out of high school called the Dick Halverson Big Band. And, they probably would have chosen a life of music in the music business, I should say. But back then, in the 40s, tour buses were not really the tour buses that they became. They were cold and uncomfortable and drafty. And, you know, so they opted for a more normal life. And my dad went off to fight in World War II, and then he came back and sort of made his way through the merchandising industry up to managing stores and things like that. But there was always music in the house. Mom always played piano. There was an acoustic piano in the house and daily played. And every once in a while, Dad would drag out his saxophone. And he was involved in the barbershop quartet music of the era.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was always fascinated with the harmonies and things, and would sit and listen to his quartet that would come to the house to practice every once in a while. And Mom sometimes would even play piano for them as they would sing, and she was a part of the barbershop quartet counterpart, which was the Sweet Adeline, they were called. So they had women's choruses and things like that. So music was always there, is what I'm trying to say.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they sat me at a piano by the time I was 6 or 7 years old and said, "You're going to take piano lessons." And I was typical of any 6 or 7 year old boy and wanted to go out and, you know, chase garter snakes instead of practicing piano. But I gained a certain knowledge, you know, from the piano. And then by the time I was 15, I had found an old Spanish style acoustic guitar in my grandparents' attic. And of course, that was around the era of, you know, Elvis and Bill Haley and the Comets and Gene Vincent and the Fendermen, you know, Mills, Neil Skinner Blues, things like that. And it just, the guitar attracted me, you know. So I found myself gravitated more toward guitar than I was toward piano, though I do play some piano today. I probably play a lot, I'm a little more intellectual about guitar than I am piano, but guitar was always that thing that just sort of drew me, you know. So I've got a small collection of guitars that's really pretty spectacular, and I've got about four of them sitting out all the time. And I practice every day, and of course the boys in the band, Woody, Mike, and Jamie, they're all jazzers, you know. They really are accomplished players.
Yeah.
And they were the ones over the last 15 years that really kind of convinced me just by watching them play and listening to their abilities, you know, to learn how to play the music of the big band era, so to speak. So I've got some knowledge, and I enjoy playing that kind of stuff now. So, you know, Mr. Saturday Dance. I might have gone, but what for? You know, that kind of mm-hmm. stuff is so cool. Mm-hmm.
All those standards. Those great standards. So, when you were young, when you were starting with the guitar, were there any particular songs that just stood out that you would spend hours trying to figure out and copy? You know,
there probably were. I remember one song in particular that just there was nothing to it, and I just happened to hear it in some film we were watching the other night. Was Link Wray, if you remember his name, and it was a song called Rumble. Look it up, you'll find it online.
I will.
It's a very cool sound with a tremolo on his guitar, and very, very out of tune and ragged, but it drew me. There was also a song called Apache
mm-hmm.
by Jorgen Ingman. There was Honky Tonk by Bill Doggett. Bill Doggett combo, which had a great guitar segment. It also had a great saxophone. And today, if I hear it, I'll turn it up because it's just one of those iconic sort of things to me. And of course, I grew up with Elvis, you know, so Scotty Moore and people of that ilk always attracted me. What was the guy's name that was in Ricky Nelson's band? Name slipped my mind.
James Burton?
James Burton, yeah. People like him, you know. So,
Who wound up
emulate them?
Yeah, who? James Burton actually wound up being Presley's main go-to guy when during his last years playing live. Phenomenal.
Sure did,
Telecaster guy.
Fantastic players and wonderful emotions beneath what they did, you know, and that's what always drew me to music, something that can move me emotionally. It doesn't matter if it's rock and roll or if it's gospel or if it's blues, you know, if it can move me emotionally, I'm attracted to it.
Well, I think that's evident in your performance too, because your performance is very eclectic that way, where your material ranges from those exact genres, from a rock and roll mm-hmm. to a pop to a gospel, and you've been very good at pulling it off too. A lot of artists can't do that. You've been very good at pulling that off.
Well, thanks. And we have done a bit of those different genres through my life, and we'll probably continue, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They say to me, when are you going to retire? And I always go, I don't know that I could retire, you know, because it's under your skin and in your heart and soul. And
exactly.
Why would you not want to be doing it, you know, other than the fact that you might not enjoy it anymore, you know. But it's hard not to enjoy the people who love the music so much, and it's hard not to enjoy having a camaraderie and being able to play the music with three guys like Woody, Jamie, and Mike.
Now, as a kid, where do you go from? Did you wind up moving to California? How did you just get discovered or picked out? Did you form the Union Gap? Did you create that? Or was it created for you?
It was all my idea. I grew up in the Yakima Valley and moved to Twin Falls, Idaho, as my dad got moved around. And then right out of high school, we moved to San Diego, California. And that was where I was, you know, I was now a teenager and very much into the idea of playing music on the scene, whatever that was. So we would work in the boys' clubs if I could get into a band or something like that, you know. And there came a point. Of course, more like anybody with enough practice or whatever, you know, you get into a group that has a little bit of some sort of success, you know, that is playing like I say, at the Boys Club, San Diego was is a very military town. So there were a lot of military installations that we could go work at, even as teenagers, because they didn't serve alcohol and things, you know.
Right.
If you wanted to work the enlisted men's clubs, for instance, you know.
And you could get away with doing covers for the night.
Oh, and that's what we did. We did covers because covers were what people, what we grew up on, you
right.
know, and we were doing all the R&B of the day and dance music and things. And then, you know, of course, at some point in 1963 and 4, as we turned into our 20s and things, you know, the Beatles came along and that kind of stuff, you know, and of course the Drifters were there and groups like that, you know, the Miracles and we played the music because it was fun, you know, and we were experiencing the world through the music, through the people that came to dance and stuff like that, you know. So there came a point, I think, when I realized that I wanted to get out of nightclubs. You know, I could see that they were not going to be a great future for me. So I thought, yeah, I'd really like to put something together and be able to record, hopefully have a record deal, hopefully make records that people would want to buy, and thereby, you know, getting out into the world and being able to be out in the concert scene and so forth, you know. So that was my goal as we worked along. And I was in a couple of different groups in high school. I was in a group called the Redcoats. And we were just a typical little high school band, you know, that was fortunate to play at the Sock Hop.
Mm-hmm.
Like that. But we were playing the music of the day, you know, and that would have been Gene Vincent and Elvis Presley and, you know, the Coasters and the Platters and Fats Domino,
right.
and Little Richard and whoever else, you know. Suppose the guy, Summertime Blues,
Eddie Cochran.
People like that, you know. Yeah. So, and then out of high school, I, you know, got into a group that was just a big kind of R&B group. We were like 12 people, which was, you know, in itself it was foolish, but it was fun because we had a horn section and a rhythm section, and we had four singers, and, you know, they danced and they sang, and, you know, and we all ended up making $2 every night that we worked. So we finally realized that wasn't very profitable. So we went from 12 pieces to 4 pieces overnight, you know, and then we started working in the nightclubs and things. And I realized that the nightclubs were tough, you know, they were difficult. We worked in a lot of the clubs that were in, I'll just call it Sailor Town. I don't say that disparagingly, but
no.
We worked down in National City where a lot of enlisted men, you know, they mm-hmm. were just out drinking, dancing, having fun, you know,
you
that's what they wanted
if,
to do.
If you want this for your career, you can't go much farther. You know, it's kind of like, in a way, it's a dead end in many ways.
Yep. So, oh, absolutely.
So you were fortunate to land yourself a record contract.
Yeah, well, it took a while, actually. I mean, you know, I really kind of worked in the local scene for, I don't know, 7 or 8 years or something like that, you know, working through the clubs and things. I finally ended up in a group called the Outcasts, which was put together by a club owner in San Diego. He had a place called the Quad Room. And he had discovered the bass player, his name was Bob Brown, and me, along with somebody else, working in town, and he said, "You guys are really good together," because we used to do all the Righteous Brothers stuff and things of that nature, you know, Everly Brothers even, you know, and,
mm-hmm.
and Bobby had that screaming kind of raspy voice, but we could do the, you know, the R&B of the day and all that, and he, the club owner, his name was Yale Kahn, and he had discovered a drummer that he really loved a lot by the name of Tommy Kendall, and Tommy Kendall, Bobby Brown, and I were invited to meet him at his office one day, and he said, "I want to make a band out of you guys and put you to work in my club and give you a weekly job." And we just went, "Whoa, okay, let's do this," you know. So he put us in this place called the Quad Room, and we were really a good trio because I was a good enough guitar player, plus I had a B3 organ, And
you had to carry that thing. You had to carry that thing from show to show.
Well, no, we really didn't, because he put us in the quad room for good.
Okay, so it was permanent.
We were there for 2 years, and over that 2 years, we became a really good, tight trio, and it was a very, what's the word I want, clicky kind of club, clique of people who, you know, were gathered, the hairdressers of the day, the, you know, whoever it was, they would come to that club on a nightly basis to dance and play and drink and have fun. And so we were there for 2 years until finally Bobby and Tommy, who were always at odds, just fought it out too much. And I said, you know, guys, I'm out of here. And that was when I started looking for a band that I could lead. I didn't know how to be a leader. I didn't even want to be a leader, but I knew that I needed to do something, because now we were out of work. In fact, it was right around the time that John F. Kennedy was assassinated, and I was working night in the nightclubs, and so I was working days in a place called Foreign Auto Supply. And
so that's so late 62.
Yeah, and then it went even further than that, because it was really 64, 65, 66, finally, when this group broke up, and I started looking for, you know, other guys to be in a band. And I found all the guys finally after 4 months of looking and searching and trying. And so we started rehearsing in my garage in Claremont, California, which is a part of San Diego, just a, you know, suburb. But we rehearsed for a month, and I found a little agent up in Los Angeles. He said, come and hear this band. I want you to put us to work. And we were fortunate to be able to talk Yale Conn into putting us back into the quad room. And by this point, this agent had taken us up into Los Angeles on the road, and taken us to Seattle on the road, and then down to Portland, then down to Vallejo, California. And that was during that time on the road is when I figured out what I wanted to do, how I came up with the name and the idea of the band, because I had this interest in the Civil War history of the U.S. And one day it just occurred to me that we could all wear our Union Soldier outfits. And I had grown up in the Yakima Valley in Washington State, and Union Gap is in the southeast corner of the valley. And I just went Union Soldier, Union Gap. Fantastic.
It's a great name.
I'm good. I got it.
It's a great name.
Thank you. I appreciate that. You know, and I got a lot of, you know, sort of blowback from it, you know, in the beginning. What does that mean? That's a stupid name. What is that? I don't know. You know,
well, what's a beetle? A beetle's just a bug.
And what's a Rolling Stone? You
exactly.
Know? That's what I would. Yeah. So I said, it's a good name. It's, you know, and I didn't even put my name in front of it, to be honest with you. I just called it the Union Gap. But
didn't mean to interrupt you, but that's something, you know, because we've all been in bands, so we all know the band dynamics, and this one will you know, everyone knows it's because of them that the band is successful in their minds. So when you have your band Union Gap, you know, it does become more of a coherent band. When all of a sudden becomes Gary Puckett and the Union Gap, you know, does that cause any kind of friction? I mean, granted, it seemed to be your band from the get-go.
Well, it was. The whole idea was mine, like I said, and it wasn't even me that put my name in front of the band. It was the record company. The very first record that we made was called Woman, Woman, Have You Got Cheating on Your Mind? And it was released as the Union Gap featuring Gary Puckett, because the record company said, this doesn't sound like a band. This sounds like a singer with an orchestra, which it did.
Full so sound. You guys had a full sound.
There were nearly 30 pieces on that record, you know. So, and I'm very fortunate to have made that record, because it's a great record. It's a great song. And Jerry Fuller, our producer, produced a what is it I want to say? It has become, like many of the other records, a part of the fabric of American pop music. You know?
So exactly. It's part of that lexicon.
Yeah, exactly. So anyway, the next record was called Young Girl, and the record company just automatically put Jerry Puffin and the Union Gap, which fortunately for me, all these years later, means a lot because people recognize my name with the band name, you know?
Right. It's good branding. Very good branding.
Yeah.
Now, you did the Ed Sullivan Show.
Three times.
Your very first time, this is the stage that put Elvis on the map, put the Beatles on the map. You're going on this show. What kind of pressure? Because I rarely ever get to talk to anybody who's actually gone on the Ed Sullivan Show. What kind of pressure is on your mind knowing that the country is, you only have three television channels. So you know that the country, at least one third of the country, is going to be watching you. Of that audience are people that inspired you. You know, Elvis will be watching. The Beatles could be watching. You know, all these big people, important, the president could be watching. What is going through your mind? Are you just saying, okay, I just got to do the show? Or are you letting that pressure get to you at all? Because you look calm as can be when you watch it on YouTube. I'll pull up the old YouTube videos of you performing that. You look great. You pull off a great show.
No, thank you. I appreciate your kind words, Dan. That's really nice.
Are you wound up before that? Do you take a drink? What do you do right before that?
Well, I didn't take any drinks, no, that's for sure, because the show was taped. Was it taped or was it live? It was live. The show was live, is what it was, and that was the pressure for me. I never thought about it the way you just said, that Elvis could be watching, that the President of the United States could be watching, you know, that Pinocchio could be watching. I did not even think of it that way. I just thought when people said, you know what, this is live, and you're going to be singing to 8 million people or more, you know, that was something that scared me to death, because it just seemed like you can't make a mistake. You've got to go up there and be good, you know, and it felt like pressure, that's for sure. But it was interesting and it was fun, and somehow I got through it, and it was good.
Now, were you live with the live band, or were you live to a backing track?
I was live to a backing track. They did not in those days really know how to do live music really well.
Right.
So
the band would pantomime.
The band was pantomiming to a track that was prepared by the record company. So it was the track, The Young Girl, and what was the other one we did? Lady Willpower, I think. But I sang live.
Right.
So I'm pretty proud of that. In fact, you may even notice this on Young Girl. In those days, we had censorship. So the censors were always looking to see what should not be said on the air. And one of the things that they decided shouldn't be said on the air was the line in the song in the third verse, "'Cause I'm afraid we'll go too far." They said, "You must say, how can this love of ours go on?" So the only time that was ever said or sung, let's say, was on the Ed Sullivan Show. But now we use a clip of that in our show, and I hear it every time. How can this love of ours go on? And I just go, that cuts me up, because the Rolling Stones were told that they had to say, let's spend some time together. But of course they didn't. They said, let's spend the night together.
Well, the classic story is The Doors. A Girl We Couldn't Get Much Higher. They suggested you say, A Girl We Couldn't Get Much Better. And but Morrison wound up saying, you know, get higher. You've had an amazing career, and I'm sure you're full of memories. And what's good, what I love about you is you keep making new ones. You're out there. You keep playing. You keep pushing. You keep performing. You're making people happy. You know where you stand in pop culture, and I think you're comfortable with that.
I am. I'm thinking of doing a new project, and we'll see what comes out of it. But right now life is busy enough, particularly with what we have going on and the stay-at-home issues and things like that. But I am comfortable with who I am. I'm a lucky guy to have a wonderful little family. Both our daughters are grown, and the older daughter, like I said, being a doctor and having three children, she's with us 24/7. So we're experiencing childhood all over again because we have an eight-month-old along with a three-year-old, a six-year-old. So that's a lot of fun. Our younger daughter is 31 June, and she's married, and they've got their first little house. So that's all wonderful stuff. As far as, you know, the band goes, I'm a lucky guy. They are the best band in rock and roll as far as I'm concerned. They can play anything for anybody at any time because they all read, write, teach, et cetera. And they bring me up to their level, and we're able to walk away from a concert with people saying, that was great. I was entertained. I had a really good time. We hope to see you back soon. So I'm good.
Well, I can't wait to hear more from you, buddy. Can't wait to see you when you're in the Atlantic City area. You got to hook me up. Let me know.
All right. You bet I will. Well, you have my phone number there now in your phone?
Yeah, I got everything. I got your phone number. I got your email. It's been so good to hear from you. If I could just have one quick favor, if you can give me a quick station ID. Our network is WNJHradio.com, WNJHradio.
Let me get something to just write down. If there's something you want me to say, I just want to say it in one fell this week. So let me grab a pen here.
Sure.
All right. How do you want me to say it?
This is Gary Puckett. You're listening to WNJHradio.com.
WNJH. Okay, .com. The thing was, okay, here we go. Hi, this is Gary Puckett, and you're listening to WNJHradio.com.
Thank you so much. Hey, stay safe and stay healthy.
You do the same, Dan. Let's stay in touch, man.
All right, buddy. Talk to you later.
Take care.
Bye-bye. Hope you enjoyed this podcast. Please be sure to tell your friends about the show. You can find The Dan Morrow Show on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, and all other listening platforms where podcasts are heard. We are also syndicated via the great online radio network of Hamilton, New Jersey, WNJHradio.com. Hey, I'm on Instagram at Dan Morrow Music, as well as Facebook, also Dan Morrow Music. And for live shows, dates, videos, updates, and all other facets of me, go to my personal website at danmorrow.com. That's DanMarrow.com. Hope you enjoyed this conversation with me and Gary Puckett. That's another one in the books, and I'll see you next time.